get this meeting of government operations started. Call the meeting to order. Let's start out with Representative. We've got some minutes here to take care of. Let's get those taken care of first. I've got the minutes from March 13th, and Representative Freiberg, have you read the minutes?
I have. They look great.
So Representative Freiberg moves the minutes of March 13th. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Minutes are passed. We also have the minutes from March 15th. Representative Freiberg, do you want to move those minutes?
Sure, I'll move them.
Representative Freiberg moves the minutes of March 15th to be approved as printed. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The ayes have it. We have the minutes from March 19th. Representative Freiberg moves the minutes of March 19th as printed. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. The minutes are approved. We have the minutes of March 20th. Representative Freiberg, you want to move the minutes of March 20th?
I will.
Representative Freiberg moves the minutes of March 20th to be approved as printed. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
Mr. Chair.
No.
The ayes have it.
Mr. Chair, I actually had the stomach flu on March 22nd. I was excused that day, so somebody else may want to move that day.
Representative Lean, would you, if you looked at the minutes of March 22nd, Representative Lean moves the minutes of March 20th. All in favor of the minutes as printed, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. Get that little bit of housekeeping. We were busy those weeks. We didn't get the minutes to us by then. Next I have on the minutes or the agenda is House File 1152, Representative Murphy. This is the Pension Bill 2, and I'll move House File 1152 to be recommended to pass and move to
rules.
Move to rules. And Representative Murphy, you want to present your bill. Welcome to back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I start, I would like to read a statement for the record on the Omnibus Pension Bill 1152 as amended.
Go ahead, Representative Murphy.
PERA and MSRS have submitted documentation to be entered into the record of the House Government Operations Committee. The documentation provides background on the projected funding needs of the PERA Police and Fire Plan, the MSRS State Troopers Retirement Plan, and the Judges Retirement Plan, and explains the shared approach of addressing the funding needs of these plans by including increased revenue through contribution increases and benefit modifications that will affect current and future active members and benefit recipients. That concludes my statement.
Thank you.
For the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as the bill is presented, please look for some of those things that were already mentioned. The increased employee and employer contributions.
Madam Chair, I'll move the A5 amendments, get the bill in the order you want, the A5 S1191-5A amendment, excuse me, to get the bill in the shape that the...
Please do that, because...
All in favor of the 5A amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment's approved. Now the bill's in the order you want. We'll
thank you, and that's the order that I've been working off. So thank you very much. Also, when the bill is being presented, look for increased vesting in the various plans, and you'll notice that there is perhaps less encouragement for early retirements than the previous pension bills that have been brought before you have had. There are reduced COLAs, and keep in mind that the 2010 reforms were not strong enough. They set the groundwork and they set the framework for these increased adjustments to the various plans that we have in Pension Bill 2. Article 1 deals with the State Patrol Retirement Plan, and it ensures that there are going to be more solvency measures. It lowers liabilities by $34 million, and 70% of the solution is borne by employee contribution increases and benefit reductions. It was agreed to by the various unions and retirees representing members of the State Patrol Plan. The proposal includes employee contributions going up on July 1st, 1% in 2014, and 1% on July 1st, 2016. It increases employer contributions 1.5% on July 1st, 2014, and another 1.5% in July 1st, 2016. It also reduces the post-retirement increase paid to retirees from 1.5% to 1% effective coming January. And it was already lowered in 2010, so this is an additional step on that. And it increases vesting from 5 years to 10 years for new hires. Article 2 is a provision asked for by PERA, and in that it clarifies what is and what is not going to be considered salary for purposes of reporting contributions and calculating benefits for all of PERA's retirement plans. It clarifies. There was much discussion on some things, some issues that this is really salary. No, it isn't. Yes, it is, kind of thing. This clarifies what is considered salary. And it came upon agreement after much discussion. Article 3. It's PERA police and fire financial solvency measures. It lowers liabilities by over $457 million. 78% of the solution comes from members' contribution increases and member and benefit recipient benefit reductions. It was developed by a group of police and fire members and some benefit recipients. It's a shared sacrifice approach, very similar to the 2010 proposal. And in this proposal, vesting is increased to full vesting at 20 years, partial from 10 years. And it sets a cap for new members at 33 years. Article 4 is TRA early retirement reduction factors. This article tends to lessen the significant negative impact of new early retirement factors that were caused by the recent change in actuarial methods. Early retirement penalties will increase for teachers retiring before the age of 62. But they will lessen for teachers who remain working past age 62, and especially for long service teachers with 30 years or more of experience. Article 5 is the article that perhaps you've heard most about. Article 5 is funding with state aid. the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Financial Solvency Plan and the Duluth Teachers Financial Solvency Plan. These measures are designed, the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund, these measures are designed to address a deficiency of approximately 6.4% of the St. Paul Public School annual salaries, $16.7 million. The proposal provides $17.2 million in additional revenue and benefit modifications. The Duluth Teachers Fund Association is increasing employee contributions from 6.5% to 7.5%. The employer contributions are 0.71% to 0.75%. Changing the COLA to the same as the St. Paul teachers. The Duluth teachers is asking for $6 million for 27 years. Article 6 is the judges' retirement plan financial solvency measures. The plan was developed by the District Judges Association. It immediately lowers the liabilities by $5.2 million. It eventually saves another $24.7 million in the next 20 to 25 years. It increases the judges' contributions. It increases the court's contributions. It lowers the cost of living adjustments. It lowers the formula multiplier for judges hired after 2013. And it gives a choice to non-vested judges. Article 7 amends the current provision regarding voluntary membership dues deductions. And it allows the unions to submit for blind mailings information that they want their members to receive. No addresses will be known. That concludes my brief summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Martin is the expert on retirement and pensions that we always depend on, and he is here. There are also members of each of the plans here, and they can answer specific questions. And I'm going to pay very close attention to the questions and the answers so that when we get to the floor, I will be able to answer them again.
And we have two people who want to testify, but first, any member questions of the bill? Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll probably have a few more later, but I just wanted to ask some questions right now on Article 7. Mr. Chair, I know that's in Representative Murphy's bill, but I believe that was a portion of your bill, so I'm not sure who would prefer to answer the questions.
I can answer questions on it, or Representative Murphy can, but go ahead. Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair, I am highly concerned about Article 7, for several reasons. I don't think it's appropriate at all. I don't think it's appropriate to make dues deduction mandatory in a pension system. And I'm, I guess I'll just kind of lay out my grievances, and then you can explain. One of you two can explain why you think that this is appropriate, because I think it's highly inappropriate. There's a section 51.14. You're saying that these mandatory payments can also be used for other payments. I'm not sure what the other payments are, and I don't believe it's appropriate to expand that or to change the word may from shall in the first place. I don't think it's appropriate to increase the frequency of deductions, and I certainly don't think that line 51.22, where it removes the requirement that they can't be used for political purposes, I think that is absolutely outrageous. I do not think that this should be used for political purposes. People should not have their payments used for political purposes against their will when they're apparently required to, they're going to be required to pay this. It's not, it's going to be a mandatory requirement. I think it's appalling. And I don't understand why it would be appropriate for to authorize blind mailings on behalf of labor organizations. And in my mind, all of this section is completely inappropriate. And I guess if you could just explain to me why this is in here and why we feel this is important, I'd sure appreciate it if either one of you could talk about that.
Representative Pepin, first off, they're voluntary, not mandatory. They say they can be done at the request. If you look online, 551.13, they can be done at the amount, at the request of the annuitant. That's the person getting the pension. If they request that these dues, that these deductions be taken out of their pension instead of having to write a check themselves, that's voluntarily done, and can be, that's where the shell is, the fund. If an annuitant says, I want those dues deducted from my dues, the dues deducted from the or those payments deducted from my pension, the pension plan shall do that if the new one asks for it. So it's not a mandatory deduction, it's a voluntary deduction. The second part where you're saying that they have to do political mailings, if you look on line 51.26, such mailings shall not be used for purposes of supporting a candidate, political party, or a ballot measure. So they cannot be used for political mailings. This is just for informational, for these mailings, the blind mailings, and the way blind mailings happen is the union, in this case, would bring the mailing if they want to go out. They'd ask the pension plan how many they need to print up. They'd bring them to the pension plan in envelopes, pre-sealed, and then the addresses label, address labels or the addresses would be put on them by the pension plan. So there are no information going back to the union, and this is information, these are that they would be sent out to the annuitants that are members of the union or were former members of the union, because a lot of times when these people retire, they no longer are members of the union. This is information that they want to go put forward to their past members. So this is, again, they're not for political purposes, they're blind mailings. The union will have no information who they are unless these people respond to the mailing. And again, it's not mandatory deductions, it's voluntary deductions being asked for by the annuitants. So, and I don't know if that allays any of your fears or not, but Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It doesn't really help my fears for two reasons, because of the plain language of the bill and because of the memo that I received from Mr. Martin. Line 51.12 says the executive director of the public pension fund shall deduct from the retirement annuity, whereas before it said may. So I think that that's, you know, the memo from Mr. Martin said, in line one of his memo, said the deduction of retirement annuity amounts by MSRS or PARA is made mandatory than rather permissive. Apart as far as the political purposes that on 51.22, it does say later about the candidate, political party, or ballot measure, but political purposes is a much broader statement than eliminating to candidate, political party, or ballot measure. And again, the memo from Mr. Martin says, the restriction against retirement annuities deductions for political purposes is eliminated. I'm still not sure what other payments are on 51.14, but I think we certainly should lay out what any of those other payments should be before we would agree to such language. And obviously I don't have the votes, but I'm really quite surprised by this I'm surprised by the whole bill, but this section is very surprising to me. But we can argue about it, so I guess you can go on to other questions or folks, but I don't think this is appropriate at all.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you'd like to call on me as a co-member of the Pension Commission with yourself and Representative Murphy for some backgrounding on these things, I'm happy to help. And this is an area where I think I can provide the committee some background on this. I had asked a question when we were bringing this forward, why when an individual retires, the union wouldn't be able to send out a mailing at that point to the retiree, and the answer that was given to us at the Pension Commission was that they may not always have current information and addresses of those who have retired who were members of the collective bargaining group, and that they were going to be wanting to rely on the records that the state keeps for the annuitants who are receiving those benefits, and they felt that those records would be a better source than those that were kept by the union, either at the time of retirement or into the future.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, following up on Representative Pepin's questions, it says that, as she pointed out well on line 51.14, it's for membership dues, which I take to mean that full dues and not fair share. And Mr. Chair and others, I understand, Mr. Chair, you were, this is part of the tip of the spear. But it seems that that would include political activity. Those membership dues include the 15%, which all of us know is more than 15%, but fortunately for the unions, it's codified in the statute, and the process is protects their ability to continue to do this. But it inherently means political activity in those membership dues, Mr. Chair. So I see a conflict between lines 51.14 and then lines 51.26 and 27 that say shall not be for the purpose of supporting or opposing any candidate, political party or ballot measure. Inherently in the dues there is political activity included there. So I struggle with this as it's poorly written. The intent of course is very much questioned by those of us in the minority. But I also wonder, Mr. Chair, what does or other payments mean?
My understanding, and Representative Drazkowski, or excuse me, O'Driscoll can correct me if I'm wrong, or we can get somebody up here from the union to answer the questions, but my understanding what they talked about is other payments, dealing with life insurance, things like that that they may want to have deducted. And again, this is at the request of the person getting the pension. And I see Ms. Blyles coming up here from Ask Me. Maybe she can give a better answer. As far as the dues being deducted, that's at the request of the retiree. So if I'm getting a pension and I want my dues taken out, or I want this other payment taken out from my dues, it's no different than having a bank do an automatic deduction from your bank account. That's what they're asking. It's not required that they do this. It's if they choose to do this. The other thing that I know from my local union, and I'm sure Ms. Blyle can tell that from what AFSCME does or what the public sector unions do, is usually when a person retires, there are reduced dues, and they're not paying the full dues, and you're paying a lot less than the 85%. That is not what they can charge. That's the maximum they can charge, and the 85%, or the amount that they can deduct for fair share payments, which is, again, the maximum is 85%, that's certified every year by the union and the Department of Labor, dependent on what their spending on other items are. That's the maximum they can charge. But if their spending on other items is more than 15%, they're not going to pay 85%. They spend 25% of the dues payments by the Labor Department certification on other activities that aren't covered or aren't allowed to be paid for by fair share dues. The fair share dues are less than 85%. That's not what they charge. It's the max. That's the maximum they can. So if they're only spending 10% of their dues on other activities, political activities, organizing activities, they can only charge 85% and they have to eat the other 5%. But Ms. Blyle, maybe you can answer the question what the other payments are for.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Julie Blyle, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5. And, Mr. Chairman, you are correct in your explanation of what the other payments are. They're either life insurance or for supplemental health insurance. Those are the types of things. And to alleviate the committee's concerns here with regard to the amount on the dues and the functions of these groups, I can speak firsthand because I've spoke to a number of them that are trying to get up and run. And they have questions. They have questions as to Medicare. They have questions as to their supplemental health insurance. They have questions regarding Part D insurance. They have questions as to what's happening in the legislature with various health insurance issues and also pension issues. And those are the type of discussions. They determine their own dues. And this establishes a program. It does not make it mandatory. The chairman was correct when he indicated that it's voluntary. It's up to each individual person whether or not they want to participate. So, thank you.
Representative Drazkowski.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Blyle, is your website address AFSCME.org? And if so, have any of your members ever had a problem contacting you?
Mr. Chairman. Representative Drazkowski, I'm not quite sure where you're going with the question, but I don't think they have a problem contacting me because my cell phone is up on our website and I get calls from them regularly.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Ms. Blyle, you made my point. If there's any current or past member of your organization or employee of the state of Minnesota that wants to contact your organization, your information I would expect is rather ubiquitous. And I don't understand why we are endeavoring to use government time and resources in order to push this information out to them. I mean, even I, who have never been a member of your organization, have a sense of what your website address is. So I struggle with the mere existence of this provision to begin with. But the follow-up question, Ms. Blyle, would be, how many times has there been an appeal to the Bureau of Mediation Services to determine whether your fair share percentage is accurate or not?
Ms. Blyle.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, we're talking about two separate issues here. This is the retirees. What you're speaking about is active members. When the retirees retire, they fall off of the system. This is simply a process to be able to contact them. We're talking about two different issues completely. And I think we need to be clear on that. Also, with regard to them contacting us for purposes of this, it's the only way that we can reach out to the members because when they retire, their addresses change, that type of thing. This is simply a voluntary proposal that is currently being updated. With regard to the number of times, Representative Pepin asked a question with regard to the number of times the dues are taken. Retirees ask for this. Typically, when you have amounts taken off your checking account, it's a standard amount every month. That's what they ask for. So these changes are coming forward by the retirees themselves.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Blyle, I'm struggling still to understand. You seem to make a distinction between retirees and their dues and the active members and their dues. Line 51.14 says it's for membership dues. Are those membership dues different than the people who are actively working and members of your organization?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, they are. When they determine their dues, we're talking about a simple amount of money enough to do a couple of mailings and coffee and cookies. We're talking about a venue for the members to be able to get together. This is not the same type of due structure with the 85% fair share that you're referring to with active employees.
So Mr. Chair, Ms. Blyle, how much are their dues relative to the active members?
Ms. Blyle.
Mr. Chairman, I'd have to check. I don't know the specific amount. They actually have their annual meeting coming up in 2 weeks, and I don't know off the top of my head. I'd have to get back to you.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So an observation is it seems that really it's just for organizing and keeping them organized and connected to your organization. From what I gather, it's not necessarily something that's a function of funding you, but keeping them organized so that they can be connected to your activities. But the question I would have is why are we going, Ms. Blyle, and I assume that AFSCME brought this item forward and maybe other items in this bill. Why are we going from May to Shell? Why are we telling the government they have to do this? Why?
Well, Representative Drazkowski, that the Shell is that the funds shall do this. We're not telling the government, we're telling the funds. And they shall do it if the member, if the annuitant, if the person getting the pension wants it. In the past, they haven't been. When they've been asked, they haven't been doing it. and that's why it's going from A to Shell. We're not telling the government, we're telling the pension funds. But Ms. Blau, you can maybe answer better than I.
Mr. Chairman, that was a very clear answer. That's correct.
Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair, it still hasn't been made clear. We're paying for membership. They're paying membership dues and soliciting past members to become members through these blind envelopes, which you described very well to us. And then in later on in 51.26 and 7, it says, shall not be for the purpose of supporting or opposing any candidate, political party, or ballot measure. It seems to me that that's wide open for legal challenge. Anyway, that's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pepin.
I have a clarifying question on something you said, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pepin.
You're changing the word from may to shall, and I'm still not clear why if may is permissive, so they already can do that. Now we're forcing it. But you've made something that made it seem like they weren't doing that. So in the past, when someone's authorized one of these retirement plans to ask to have their funds deducted, they haven't done it? Is that what you're saying? I don't understand why. I'm just not understanding why the may has to turn into shall.
Ms. Blyle.
What's the problem?
Ms. Blyle.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pepin, this makes it very clear that if the members elects to do this, that the system shall deduct. And like I said, it's entirely voluntary whether or not the member decides to do it. But this assures the follow-through.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
On that point, that the pension plan director shall do it on a monthly basis. Currently, it's been
twice a year.
Twice a year. We're switching from twice a year to a monthly basis. And there was testimony at the Pension Commission that was no problem. But I'd also like to insert that this would not be to the cost of the pension plan or the annuitants. It would be, the cost would be borne by the people that were preparing the blind envelope.
Yes. Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. If there isn't any other discussion on this topic, I would like to go to another section of the bill, if I could.
And I think Representative Drazkowski had his hand up. Is it on this topic? Or
it is, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair.
We'll come back to you, Representative.
Representative Murphy, Ms. Blyle, how do we know that, where you're striking the part that says that it can't be used for political purposes, and then we're going on and saying it's not going to be used for political purposes, or it can't be used for supporting or opposing a candidate. This is so very confusing. It seems to me that we are leaving it wide open for these dollars. Now, you mentioned it's going to be used for cookies and gathering and organizing your folks for I don't know what. Well, I do. How do we know that it's not going to be used for political purposes?
Ms. Blyle.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, I think if you read the language, it's actually much more clear than the existing language was, because it ties down specifically on what can and cannot be put into the mailings. I think it's more clear.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Drazkowski.
Well, Ms. Blyle, I understand that on 2.6 and 2.7, the mailing specifically cannot be used for political purposes, but the money that you are getting from them.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, again, the money that we're getting from them, the amounts is what they determine. If they elect to have deductions taken, that is their option. It's not mandatory. It's not within the purview of discretion as to what types of information are going into either the blind mailings or additional mailings. This is up to the members within the Retiree Council to decide what they would like to do.
So, Mr. Chair and Ms. Blyle, so Again, we don't, I mean, it seems evident that that's going to potentially be used for membership dues or for, excuse me, for political purposes by your organization. There's nothing here saying that that's not going to be used for political purposes.
Ms. Bly.
If you intend it to be for cookies, let's write cookies in there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jaskowski, if an individual member wants the opportunity to contribute for political purposes, they still have that right to do so. This is not changing any right that they may have. I guess with regard to the dues themselves, they decide how much these dues are going to be. These are deductions.
So,
Representative Jaskowski.
So, Ms. Blyle, you could use that money then that you get from these retired members for political purposes. Is that what you just told me?
Ms. Blyle.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jaskowski, they would have to specifically check off if they want money to go for political purposes. That's not within the definition of the dues themselves.
Representative Jaskowski.
It sounds like a yes, Mr. Chair, but that's all I guess that's as much definition as we're going to get there.
Well, Representative Jaskowski, the members, as she's explaining, the members of the retirees group could choose to do what they want with the money they collect as their dues. That's all done by vote at their meetings. It's not something that's we're getting involved in. What you're talking about is getting involved in some people's constitutional First Amendment rights of how they want to spend their money, and we can go on from there. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I might have a question for Mr. Martin to get to the bottom of something I've been trying to figure out.
Representative Mr. Martin. Representative Pepin, go ahead with your question.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Well, this is requiring MSRS and PARA to deduct membership dues for a labor organization, so an outside organization. And I'm just wondering, is that your knowledge in the system? Does that happen frequently? Are mandatory or pension systems generally required to make mandatory deductions on behalf of other organizations? Is that something that's done frequently? And just wondering if there's an additional cost as well.
Mr. Martin, and if you could say your name for the tape.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm Larry Martin. I'm the Executive Director of the Legislative Commission on Pensions. I assume your question is nationally or within Minnesota. Within Minnesota, these are the only two plans that have had this are PERA and MSRS. This is a piece of legislation, the base provision of law passed 2 or 4 years ago, so it's not been around for very long. There's no provision comparable to this for the various teacher plans. I can't answer whether there's any cost to this, but we have the directors of MSRS and PERA here. I also don't have any clear understanding, since there's no centralized clearinghouse of information for the 9,000 or so public employee pension plans in the country, what the experience is in other jurisdictions, unfortunately. Mr. Bergstrom, who is an officer, I believe, in the National Association of State Retirement Administrators, may have some information about state retirement plans that he can provide for us.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. I guess I'm not sure. I'm just curious because I don't know what other payments means. You gave some suggestions that probably should be laid out clearly. I mean, you know, I don't know what other types of dues could be added. It just seems like requiring MSRS and PARA to make these deductions, I don't know what this could turn into, what other payments that could turn into on behalf of labor organizations. I personally don't think it's appropriate at all, but if I could find any other information about if that's, maybe that's commonly done in other pension plans in the country. It just seems to me that, it just doesn't seem appropriate to me that these retirement plans should have to do this, should be required to do this. I don't know.
Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Blyle just showed me her electronic device, and there's at least 42 systems across the country that do this provision.
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that require, in other words, that requires the retirement system to deduct for labor organizations, deduct dues? Is that what you're testifying?
Representative Murphy.
That, or that allows?
That allows.
Okay, well.
I don't know about how many of them are required.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. That it already is permissive. This is requiring, so it's, I think that's different. I don't know. Mr. Chair, I would like to move to remove Article 7, delete Article 7 from the pension bill.
Representative Pepin moves to delete Article 7 from the bill. Representative Falk.
I'm just trying to understand this because I keep hearing mandate or they may or shall. Doesn't the person or the people receiving the benefit from the pension, they'd have to request this? I mean, if the presumption is first that it's mandatory, you wouldn't need to have the request made by the people actually receiving benefits from the pension. I'm confused here. So, because I keep hearing these things run around, and could I get that clarified? Because if I understand, you actually have to request that these withdrawals go to the particular dues, it wouldn't actually be a mandate then, right?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Falk, if you read the language, it's the mandate is on MSRS and PARA that they have to do it upon request. I'm not saying that the recipients are mandated to do this. I'm saying that this is saying that upon written authorization from the person receiving the annuity, MSRS has to do it. And my concern is that that could be expanded to other payments. And so we're having MSRS be some sort of clearinghouse for the labor organization. It's not that I understand that it's not mandatory on the person. I'm saying that it's mandatory on the retirement plans. Mr. Chair, I'd also like a roll call. Or I'd like a, roll call.
A roll call. Roll call's been requested. And
Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Falk.
I guess to the comments that Representative Pepin offered, I mean, you could have hypotheticals for anything. But I'm just curious, I mean, if it's potential, I mean, it is the pension recipient's money. I mean, if they've put money into this, and why wouldn't their request be honored? I mean, seeing that this is being changed because apparently this hadn't been the case, so, I mean, if it's their money, why can't they do as they see appropriate?
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Falk. Because I could amend this and say that the MSRS would also have to, at my request, deduct my child care payments or my gym dues or anything else is my concern. I don't know what other payments are. I just don't think that they should be the clearinghouse for, they're not a bank.
But I guess, Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I mean,
Ball.
You could make that request, but you're not. And I mean, are you one of the pensionees here? Or, I mean, it's just, if this is something that they're asking for, right. I don't see this as, you know, hugely controversial.
Representative Pepin, any answer, and we'll go to a vote.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chair, I can try to explain, but I don't think that Representative Falk gets what I'm saying, so I just give up.
Roll call being requested on the amendment to remove Article 7 on page 51 from the bill. I'll go first. Right. Clerk will take the roll.
Nelson?
No.
Freiberg?
No.
Pepin?
Aye.
Thorholt?
No.
Fiskowski?
Aye.
Falk?
No.
Hansen?
No.
Kahn? Ween?
Nay.
O'Driscoll?
Yes.
Hugh?
Yes.
Sanders?
Yes.
Tice?
Yes.
Winkler?
No.
Dill's here now.
Oh.
Dill?
No.
Vote with 8 no's and 6 ayes, the amendment fails. Representative O'Driscoll, you had a question on another portion of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We may need Ms. Bannock for this and or Mr. Martin. One of the provisions, just for the background of this committee, and Representative Murphy highlighted this, is that there's a clarification in here as to what is considered salary for the computation of PERA and other benefits. And one of the things that we had discussion quite extensively, I think, in pension commissions was law enforcement officers receive uniform allowances, and sometimes those allowances are the municipality may have an account with a certain vendor or provider, and or they may maintain their own if they're a large enough organization. Their own, if you will, company store. And the clarification that we were looking at was whether a municipality for bookkeeping purposes and at the preference of a collective bargaining agreement would just pay cash benefits to the officers and then they would purchase their uniforms and be responsible for it. My understanding was that we were going to include as not considered or to be deemed as salary those cash benefits. And I cannot find that in the bill under the general PERA provision or under the police and fire provision. And I may just be missing it because it's a rather large bill. Second component on that is if it's specifically for police and fire, I know that other departments or agencies within a municipality may offer that same benefit. So I think that that needs to be consistent with PERA language and MSR. Language as well. So I'd like to maybe just probe that a little bit because, again, this morning as I'm looking through the bill, I don't see that. And I would ask Representative Nelson and Representative Murphy if I'm recalling the wishes of the Pension Commission correctly.
I believe that was part of our discussions. Mr. Martin can be quick. Just so you know, I may. Why don't we, before we answer that question, Ms. Crockett is asked to speak and she has to leave by 11. So why don't we let the testifiers testify and then we can get back into the questions. So Ms. Crockett, if you want to come forward, and then I also have Mr. Carlson from the Intercounty Association. Ms. Crockett, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Chairman Nelson, thank you so much for the accommodation this morning. My name is Kim Crockett. I'm with the Center of the American Experiment. For those of you who've served on the Pension Commission, like Representative Murphy and others, I'm a familiar face there on the public pension issue. So let me do a quick statement and then tell you a few specifics this morning. With all due respect to all the players here at the state level who are involved in managing our public pensions, the results are not good. Minnesota is not unique in this regard. Most states are experiencing problems. The difficulty is that no one is held accountable. Despite all of the problems that you have before you, nobody has lost their job. Yet these large unfunded liabilities, and we're at $16.7 billion conservatively now, as of January, none of these unfunded liabilities, which are backed, these unfunded liabilities are backed by taxpayers. And they are very vulnerable to the mischief and the kind of tinkering that you see before you in Omnibus 1 and Omnibus 2. Now, it's one thing for the funds to find themselves short from time to time due to market fluctuations. But the current situation is not solely caused by a tough stock market in 2008, followed by a weak economy. The funds are in trouble because the state is promising greater benefits than it can afford. More is going out than is coming in from the three sources, be it the state, the employees, or the investment funds at State Board of Investment. To continue to entertain these tweaks and even increases in benefits to a pension system that is around 70% funded is to shove the costs of today's government onto future taxpayers and generations. This violates Minnesota's own pension principles and any sense of fair play. Minnesota needs a solid retirement system for its current employees and also for its current retirees that works now and well into the future. We strongly urge you, after years of study and struggling with this issue, to reduce the increases in benefits to current retirees to help stabilize these funds and to then join other states and the private sector by shifting our great state workforce to defined benefit contributions, to defined contribution plans, that's always tricky, which are now enjoyed by some state employees, including most university employees. The three areas that I want to focus on very quickly are TRA and then the two bailouts, Duluth and St. Paul. And I would just note very much in passing with regard to the judge's plan in Omnibus 2 that this is a huge missed opportunity to go to a 401k, at least with regard to new judges. It was an amendment brought by Representative Mike Benson, and as I said, I think it's a huge opportunity lost. I find it very troubling as an attorney and member of the Minnesota Bar that judges are in a position to rule on the very pension system on which they rely for their own retirement. This is an inherent conflict of interest that does not serve them or the state taxpayer well. Now, with TRA, I would say when you're in a hole, stop digging. The TRA bill reduces the cut in the retiree benefit that you passed in 2010. And as Representative Murphy said this morning, 2010 wasn't tough enough. And it ignores the current funding deficiency, which is described quite well in the pension staff memo. We keep hearing that we should give 2010 omnibus changes time to work, so the TRA bill seems impatient at best and imprudent at worst. TRA is at about 73% funding with a $6.2 billion deficiency, which is up from about $5 billion in 2011. If this is the only legislation TRA has this year, perhaps it would be better for you to wait and see what they have to offer in the interim for a long-term recovery plan. Quickly again on the two bailouts, Duluth and St. Paul. These funds claim that their biggest problem is a rough stock market and poor investment returns, and that the state just hasn't helped them enough over the years. You know, they're kind of the stepchilds there over in St. Paul and Duluth. I ask you, what is the state taxpayer's responsibility to these funds? Even if you can make a case for the state taxpayer to come to their aid, why would you give them a cash deal without exerting control or conditions over the funds? And finally, how can you justify increasing their benefit level just because the teachers in TRA are getting it? It's not a matter of whether or not they deserve it. I'm sure that they are very good teachers, some of them not. But just because TRA gets a certain benefit level in the COLA, when they're in the hole, why would you dig a deeper hole and then bail it out? That just doesn't make any sense. Duluth is upside down. It is circling the drain with 900 active members being supporting 1,200 or so retirees with low to no growth projections for the folks in Duluth schools. So what incentive do they have if you're giving them cash to reach full funding? I reluctantly suggest this may be a candidate for a merger with TRA, but in order to hold TRA harmless, this would have to be approached with great, great caution, and I don't understand what the rush is. Finally, with St. Paul, I would say all of the above comments that with regard to Duluth apply to St. Paul, and that there's no emergency here for St. Paul. They have better demographics than Duluth. So perhaps a merger would be in order rather than just giving them cash, because again, what incentive do they have to straighten out their own situation by giving away fewer benefits given what they have coming in? I had an op-ed in the Strib on Friday which got a lot of attention, and I've taken a chunk of it and tucked it at the end of my written testimony for you. I don't want to waste your time by reading it to you, but I would urge you and plead with you on behalf of current employees, current retirees who are contacting us, by the way, every day, who are very, very worried about these, and finally, taxpayers, my kids, my grandkids, you are taking the costs of today's government and putting it onto the shoulders of future taxpayers, and that's not cricket. It cannot be defended, and yet we're doing it year after year after year. I would offer my help to you in the interim or any time to help us figure out how we can transition from this broken, defined benefit system to one that works for the state of Minnesota. Again, Mr. Chairman, thank you so much for allowing me to testify this morning with my tight schedule. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ms. Crockett. Any questions of the testifier? Representative Winkler.
Well, Mr. Chair, just a brief statement. Ms. Crockett, I've read your work in the Star Tribune for a number of years, both as a member at the Center for the American Experiment and as a local head of the Federalist Society, and understand that you've got an agenda and a mission to make a point about public pensions and the promises that we've made, and arguing that somehow we can't afford to keep the promises that we've made. And I guess I've consistently found your work to be unconvincing and unpersuasive, and to rely on myth and innuendo, and to frankly try to scare people into believing that something isn't so. And I just think you don't perform a very good public service by doing that. When it comes to my children, I hope that we leave them a legacy of actually taking care of people in their retirement and allowing them to live in dignity and to share in some of the great benefits in society that they've helped to create, rather than to leave them poor and with declining prospects in life, and to just simply roll along the way that the private sector has rolled, which is to concentrate all money and power among the very few and leave everyone else to shift for themselves. And that's the great private sector model you're advocating. I think it's out of place, and we certainly can afford to do better. And so there's no question. It's just a statement that I think that your work in this matter is highly misleading.
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler.
Ms. Crockett.
I agree that we should not leave people in poverty and without a secure retirement. And that is why I do have a mission, and I reject your characterization of my work.
Ms. Representative Pepp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Winkler. I think that's an interesting comment that you're accusing Ms. Crockett of having an agenda, and in fact, everybody has an agenda when they come here. And I will point out specifically that the labor union has an agenda, and they're written right into the bill. They're requiring the state retirement system to do their to do their bidding for them. That's written into the bill. I don't see anything from Ms. Crockett that's actually written into the bill, and that's just one tiny little fraction of this. So I would just suggest we use caution when we accuse people of having an agenda to make it seem like because they have an agenda. Ms. Crockett works for a think tank, and that's what they do. They think about issues, and I just think it's offensive when we treat people as though when they come to the table to testify on their issue, especially when, ironically, she just speaks after someone who clearly has an agenda written in right into the bill. It's just surprising, and I would just encourage us all not, when we have private citizens that come to the table, not to use words such as agenda, or say you've got issues with this, and I've looked at your work over the years, and it's been horrible. I just think it's inappropriate here.
Mr. Carlson, you want to come down and testify? Thanks, Ms. Crockett. And
you're welcome.
Mr. Chairman, in deference to the committee's time, I'll pass on that one. Thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll, you had a question on another portion of the bill.
I've been trying all morning, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Maybe Mr. Martin or Ms. Vanek will, if they need some help on clarification, I'm happy to do that. But I think it was pretty straightforward what I was looking for.
And Mr. Martin, you remember his question regarding the
yes,
uniform
Mr.
allowance
Chair, I do.
Piece?
The question is really relates to Article 2 of the bill, which is the general salary definition that's applicable to all PERA plans, PERA Police and Fire, PERA General, or PERA Correctional. And the specific language that Representative O'Driscoll wants to look at is on page 9, line 6, there's a reference to allowance payments or per diem payments, or the reimbursement of expenses. And if you look back on page 8, line 34, this is the portion of the definition of salary that indicates what salary does not mean. So this is a specific exclusion of allowances, which would include uniform allowances.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Martin, just again from a public policy standpoint, does that language need to be, or is it included for those who may be covered by MSRS? Because I know that we do have correctional officers, and if I'm not mistaken, State Patrol is under that as well, who may or may not at some point fall into that same type of definition, just so that we're being consistent with those who are providing the same job service or job duties to the taxpayers in the state.
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, as I, when the commission dealt with this bill, as I pointed out in my issue memorandum to you, the definitions of salary among the various pension plans do differ as to their length and the extent of their specificity. They all generally follow the same rubric, but PERA's is the most explicit, the most detailed. So no, the other plans do not have exactly this language.
And Mr. Martin, do they need that language, or is that something for a future bill?
Mr. Chair, it merits looking at them carefully at some point, yes.
Representative O'Driscoll.
And Mr. Chair, I do not, by my inquiry or offering these comments today, want to think that people think that I'm picking on or singling out police and fire. As I mentioned in my opening comments on this, it is customary within different departments within a city that there be a city required uniform or something to identify people, perhaps when they go door to door to do water meter readings or to meet with citizens or to be more readily identified in the community. And they may or may not be receiving those from the company store, as I had referred to earlier, and that may be coming as a direct reimbursement to employees. And I just want to make sure that we are not creating different rules for different folks who are covered by the same pension when calculating benefits.
Representative Driscoll, sounds like something we might want to email the chair of the Pension Commission as something to look at in the interim for future reference. But for right now, this is what's in the bill. Any further questions on the bill? Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would defer to other members, but I would like to make kind of a closing observation as a member of the Pension Commission when that's appropriate.
Any further members' questions? Anybody? Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a big bill, and it's, for those that haven't been on the commission, it's a very difficult read, and appreciate your indulgence as we try to understand this. And Mr. Martin, I'm just curious, as I look through this, and especially looking at Article 5, the bailout article, that it appears, at least from some of what I have seen, that we are, could you just review for us, we are using taxpayer dollars, millions of taxpayer dollars, to bail out or provide additional solvency to these two funds, and it appears at the same time the employer is also increasing its annual contribution as well. Is that right? And could you kind of review for us what that is? And then on the other end, what have we done in terms of reducing the amount of dollars that retirees are taking from the funds?
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chair, our representative, Krasnowski, the bill relates to both the Duluth Teachers and the St. Paul Teachers Plan. In each case, it does increase member contributions, it increases the school district contributions, and it increases the amount of direct state aid that each of these two pension plans receive. So that's from the funding side. And I can point out specifically what the increases are if you want to get into that level of deep detail. From a benefit side, it changes early retirement reduction factors for St. Paul teachers. It imposes additional contributions for retired teachers who are reemployed by the school district. It does away with, it provides a forfeiture rather than a deferral for amounts that are received by reemployed annuitants in and above the earnings limitation. I'm certain I'm missing some of the other benefit provisions. For St. Paul teachers, it also increases the amount of time that someone has to terminate their from active teaching in order to be considered a retired.
Representative Skowski.
So, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Martin, thank you. Are we providing COLAs to these two groups, and have those been reduced or eliminated?
Mr. Martin.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative. In 2010 or 2011, the post-retirement increases for these two plans were reduced. The function of the 2010 legislation was to essentially eliminate the Duluth teacher cost of living increase, post-retirement adjustment. In each case, the amount of the adjustment, if any, is dependent upon the funding ratio of the pension plan. Duluth has not reached the funding level that would permit it under the 2010 legislation in order to pay additional post-retirement increases. The bill would reinstate a post-retirement increase for Duluth, a 1% increase, and that matches the increase that St. Paul Teachers is currently paying.
Representative Skowski, and I'd like to get this bill voted on by at least 20 after we have another bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Martin. So what I think I'm hearing is that this bill provides, at least for the Duluth teachers, and maybe it's similar to St. Paul, I don't know, that the Duluth teachers are increasing the amount of money the retirees are taking from the pension while also increasing the amount the taxpayers are paying in a taxpayer contribution, and the employer and also increasing the amount the taxpayers are paying through the employer contribution. So we are growing the benefits and then increasing taxes on people to pay for those. And these funds seem to be struggling, 69 or 70% solvency on average. Is Mr. Martin, is that what we have going on?
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, one of the things that in putting this bill together, and especially this article together, and talking about the future of the funds that are in this article, was that we measured very carefully was the equity, having equity. And it has been suggested by some that we take different methods to receive solvency, and if in a comparison with the Duluth, St. Paul, and TRA, the Teachers of Minnesota, that there are inequities. And there are inequities in the amounts of state aid they've been receiving. There are inequities about the numbers of years of successes that they've had, over 100 years of successes without any state aids. In particular, to your question, Representative Zalski, about the increased benefits, Duluth teacher or Duluth annuitants have been 3 years, zero COLA. They have received very limited amounts of state aid. They are in a position now where they're asking for help, but they're also asking for equity. 3 years without a COLA, whereas others in the state have had COLAs on a regular basis. And so to provide some more equity, in this case, they are going from zero to one.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Skowski.
And Representative Murphy, well, I appreciate the idea of equity, and it's a kind of a different avenue than conventional thinking would go, I guess. We have funds that are failing here, and we continue to take more from these funds. Now, I understand, I remember the first hearing we had, I don't know, Mr. Martin, you or someone I asked, and I did some follow-up reading. COLAs are not common in the private sector. The question I have, should we be doing COLAs at all in any of these funds, Representative? These funds are failing, and we continue to go to the taxpayers and take more of their money to bail them out instead of structurally fixing the problem we have in the first place. And we're doing more of it, and we're placing this fund, and I don't know, Mr. Martin, if the St. Paul Fund is similar and some of these other, we're going the wrong direction. Mr. Martin, what are we treating the St. Paul Fund similarly?
Mr. Martin.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Our representative, what this bill does is places Duluth on the same level as St. Paul Teachers. St. Paul Teachers currently provides a 1% post-retirement increase, and this reinstates a post-retirement increase for Duluth at 1%.
Representative Skowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Martin, what is the term again? Percent paid or percent funded? How does St. Paul compare to the average?
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chair, Representative, Duluth Teachers is at the, according to the 2012 actuarial evaluation, 63.4% funded. St. Paul Teachers is 61.98% funded.
Representative Ruskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Martin, it appears that St. Paul is in similar trouble. We should, members, be sending this bill back for some more work. We have two funds here, at least in this part of the bill, that we're heading in the wrong direction. We're taking more money from the fund and telling the taxpayers, here's the bill. You get to pay more. This isn't going on in the private sector. What are we doing? Mr. Chair, I think we need to send the bill back to the commission. Thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll, if you want to give your comments.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to, although she has left, thank Ms. Crockett for her comments and Representative Winkler to your comments. One of the things that I've learned over the years, working with people who are PERA or pension recipients, as well as those in the private sector, we used to have private sector pensions, and some of the things that Representative Draskowski has pointed out are the fundamental issues. Either the person who pays into a 401k or some other kind of deferred benefit plan makes the investment decision, or you shift that risk for the investment decision to what we've done here in the state of Minnesota, to a prescribed pension. And we rely on, in this case, the State Board of Investment to hit a bogey that we hope will happen. And part of the issue that we have is we don't think that as individuals we can meet that bogey. And so we're shifting the risk from an individual to the pension plan with prescribed benefits. And what I put forward to this committee and to others is that trend is going to be problematic when we move forward. $16 billion with a B shortfall right now in funding pensions. We can say that, well, you know, 8.5%, we moved that to 8%. If we moved it back to 8%, that would take care of our problems. We had a nice return in the last 6 to 7 months in the stock market and the underlying investments. That's not even going to move the needle on where we are at with underfunding these pensions right now. You might be at 61 or 62% with the St. Paul programs in Duluth, and they may bump up to 63, 64%. That doesn't solve the problem. We would have to have huge market returns. What are the issues? Annuitants are living longer, living healthier. That's not a bad thing. It's a reality. We can't change those dynamics. What we have to look at doing is how we proceed. We can't change those dynamics. What we have to look at doing is how we proceed forward with these issues of providing benefits not only to state employees but 401k and the like. One of the things that may provide some of the members on my side of the aisle a little bit of relief from the heartburn they're feeling is that the Pension Commission has agreed that in the interim, on the list of things, is looking at alternatives, because I think that the Pension Commission is feeling that this is an issue that we need to look forward to resolving in a different way than we currently are. And how to get there isn't going to happen in 1 week or one legislative session, because we didn't get there in 1 week or one legislative session. It's going to take some time to be able to turn the ship and to move it in a different direction. And that's not going to be without pain and without discussion and serious soul-searching from everyone involved in the process. And for a more global comment, there are a litany of things that are on the list, as Chair Murphy and Chair Nelson can testify to, that the Pension Commission has identified as items that need review, need some work, and need some recommendations to the legislature to keep these programs afloat.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Driscoll, thanks for your work on the Pension Commission. I know that it's long, grueling, and highly informative at the same time, and for reminding us about the basics of how this works. Members, what's irresponsible in my mind, and what I was addressing to Ms. Crockett, is this kind of doom and gloom scenario, this idea that they're, I think she said they're circling the drain, and Representative Droszkowski, I think your comments are quite irresponsible as well. They're painting a picture of the pension funds in Minnesota that are not accurate at all. You know, Minnesota's state spending, total state and local spending on pensions is 1.6% of the budget. The national average is 2.9%. In some of the outlying states where there are problems, that number goes as high as 5.6%, places like California and New Jersey. We are one of the lowest ranked states in terms of spending on pensions in Minnesota. We are extremely cautious and conservative in what we do. And to paint this picture that somehow we've been irresponsible and things are falling apart, I think is really just increasing the fear among people who are receiving pensions, and it creates an atmosphere in which you justify taking action to hurt and to not fulfill the promises that we've made to people. We are a low-spending state on pensions. If we are underfunded to some degree and ask the taxpayers to step forward, it's a product of the fact that we have been very cautious and conservative in that regard. And so I think it's very, I think it's important that we all actually understand the facts before we start to create a scenario, describe a situation in which everything is dark and getting worse, and we're leaving these terrible obligations for the future when those simply are not supported by the facts.
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess Representative Winkler brought up some of the things I was going to mention. I had served on this committee before, but I remember that Howard Bicker came and gave us a nice presentation, and I actually saved all the documents he provided in my folder. And he had, this is coming from the retirement system of Minnesota, basically a myth versus fact sheet. And, you know, he presented all this information to us, and kind of, I think, it's good to know what the actual facts are. And I think one point that should also be pointed out, and you know, we've heard a lot about private sector pensions and how they've kind of gone the way of the dodo. One of the things that I learned in some of my accounting classes and some of my study, and I found that pension accounting is very complex. And one of the things that we looked at is the number of case studies is how easily companies could go and basically rob from their pension funds. And, you know, as we've seen with companies that do different things and get bought and sold, and oftentimes those private liabilities get put onto our federal program that basically insures private pensions. And so in the end, the taxpayers end up picking up the bill, and a few people get to, you know, make bad decisions in corporate finances and corporate boardrooms, and, you know, we get stuck with the bill. I do think that we've ultimately done a pretty good job here, because if we can ensure that people have a good retirement income, it reduces the reliance on other public forms of assistance. And this is one that, you know, I do think that we did a lot of the heavy lifting that was required to be done in 2010 to shore up some of the problems that we potentially saw. But once again, we're making these decisions in the long term. And that's exactly what they talked about, too, is that these are funding decisions that are made like a mortgage on your house that you have to go and account for 20 or 30 years. And I think that we shouldn't be demonizing or fear-mongering this, because that's really not the situation that we're seeing. And I just think that it's important to keep in mind.
So I'll renew my motion.
Mr. Chair,
quickly, we've got another bill, and I want to get this voted on so quickly. Representative O'Driscoll.
Oh, thank you. To respond to Representative Winkler and to Representative Falls, since their comments were directed at my comments, the last fix that we had that was a major fix was 1989, where we shifted the tiers and the benefits and different things. Then it was 2010, and now we're short 3 years later where we're back with another major fix. Anybody want to start taking bets on when we're back for the next major fix?
Well, Representative O'Driscoll, one thing is that these three funds, while they were partially addressed, they were not given money to bail out. The ones that we dealt with and fixed in 2010 are moving in the right direction. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And other people have commented on the larger sections of the bill a lot, and I have some major concerns with it, and I'm not really sure how this encourages responsibility. I'm not sure how we justify an increase when the funds are in the hole. While this may not be as bad as other states, I haven't seen the percentages that Representative Winkler's made. I hold Minnesota higher than other states, and I think it's important that we are conservative with our investments, and I think that the public expects us to use our fiduciary responsibilities in a way that we make sure that if we're going to bail out these funds, that we bail them out in a way that makes them sustainable. And I'm not sure that this bill does that. I'm often concerned that when we attempt it in this fashion, that we're actually encouraging bad behavior. So that's my overall comments. And then just getting back to Article Section, which we haven't spent a ton of time on. I know we called it before, but you know, we're really asking the Minnesota State Retirement System and the Public Employee Retirement Association to do the bidding of a labor union. And I think that that should cause pause for everyone, because we're asking them, and Mr. Martin laid it all out very well, I think, in his memo. Maybe I'll just kind of read some of the persons briefly.
Representative Pepin, we all have the article. You don't need to read it into the tape. It's part of the record.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, it's kind of tucked in on page 51 here in a very big bill that's very controversial. And this part alone, it really deserves more scrutiny. I don't know what the other payments are, so I don't know why they're being asked to do the work of a financial services organization on being dues. We're taking out the language about being used for political purposes. I don't know what ability that PARA and MSRS would have to not do what the labor union wants. Basically, looks like it's a recruiting and communications tool, as it points out in this memo. And that's really not the primary function of the pension plans. And we really need to use caution on this section because, I think that opens up a whole can of worms. And talking about an agenda, I cannot stress how much this section is highly inappropriate. And, you know, you've got the votes, Mr. Chair, and this will come before us on the floor, and we'll talk about it again on the floor. But, you know, we all have a job here for the state and to act on behalf of the state. And, this is really something. So I would encourage a no vote.
Representative Duskowski, quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, my name was invoked, too, and I think this bill epitomizes irresponsibility, Representative Winkler, and for us to continue to throw our head under a rock in the hopes that this will all go away when we've got a $16 billion of unfunded liabilities. We continue to bail these different funds out. I've been here in three or four different legislatures when we've had bailouts. Here is another one. These are the taxpayers coming forward to bail out something that's structurally unsound. That's what we have going on here. We're taking more out of the fund than we're putting in. It's blatantly obvious in what we're doing in the bill. That Representative Winkler, is what I would term irresponsible. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So I'll renew my motion that House File 1152, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to rules. All in favor of the amendment or the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it. The bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Murphy.
Thank you.
Mr. Martin. The next bill on the agenda is House File 1705, and Representative Mariani, if you can come in and describe your bill. And members, so you know, this is a piece of the omnibus education bill. This is the rulemaking part of it that we're hearing. And in the next day, tomorrow, we'll also have a number of bills that will come before us that may or may not have House or Senate files. What these bills have been brought forward for us so that we can hear the provisions that are pertain to our committee. In this case, it's a rulemaking provision. So, And then this is, I'll move that House File 1705 be recommended to pass and re-referred to rules. And I understand there's an amendment. Is this your amendment, Representative Mariani?
Mr. Chair, yes, it is. I appreciate movement on that as well.
I'll move House File, I'll move the 1705A1 amendment to put the bill in the order that the chair wants it. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is approved. The amendment's adopted. Representative Mariani, describe what the bill does and explain why you need this exemption from regular rulemaking and why you need the expedited rulemaking.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. And this no doubt will be a much simpler bill than the previous one, which was a fascinating conversation. Mr. Chair, members, this grants the Department of Education authority for expedited rulemaking in order to amend Minnesota rules in response to new federal regulations on Part C of Special Ed, the IDEA provisions. These rules will create consistency in practice of identifying young children. The states are required to comply or else risk losing their federal Part C funding. In Minnesota, it's roughly about $7 million. The language, as the chair shared, the language here is currently sitting in our education policy omnibus bill. That bill is being vetted right now in education finance for folding into the larger bill, but we wanted to make sure that GovOps had a chance to see this language and authorize that before we move further in the education finance. The amendment that we just added would basically sunset the expedited rulemaking authority relative to what's before us on July 1st of 2014. I do have Mr. Cordy here from the Department of Education in case there are any questions specifically about why the department needs this authority. Of course, members, expedited rulemaking, in addition to being a more streamlined rulemaking process, is also a less expensive rulemaking process. This is kind of pro forma work. You know, the department periodically will need to take these steps in order to comply with federal funding, and so there's really no need to do the full rulemaking procedure. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll stand for any questions.
Any questions to the bill? Representative Pepin and Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'm unclear as to, we've already had deadlines, and it looks like there are a few bills that are coming for us that missed the deadline, and I'm trying to understand what the policy is on bills that actually miss the committee deadline, Mr. Chair.
Well, the motion was they get sent to rules, and I just was told that we need to hurry up here because rules has this room at 11:30, so, but that it's, this is the process we need to hear under our rules 403. We need to hear rules of any bill that deals with rulemaking, and that's why they wrote the separate bill to, for us to hear the portion of the bill we need to hear so we don't delay the process going forward. This, like I said, this bill will go, this bill that we're passing here today or voting on today will go to the Rules Committee. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Mariani, I guess my overall question is, this bill was heard in education and education finance, or what has been the path of this?
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, this particular provision was part of a bill that was heard in education policy. It was folded into the education policy omnibus bill, which did meet the deadline. We pushed that out to the Education Finance Committee. That committee is currently looking at this language and lots of other language in order to put together an omnibus finance bill. And again, the idea here is to make sure that GovOps got a chance to look at this language under our new rules in the House here.
Representative Pepper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry to rush you along here, but I have real concerns with expedited rulemaking process, so it's not just your bill. I'm trying to understand what the rush is. If it was such a rush, why didn't we do it earlier in the session? I'm not sure what the new codes are. I can't figure out why we can't do this next year, why we have to do it now. I just don't like the expedited rulemaking process, and I would like to know why it's necessary.
Representative Mariani.
Sure, Representative Pepin, you and I share a common concern generally about expedited rulemaking. However, this, as I said, this really is pro forma behavior on the part of our departments in order to be able to align with federal regulations. What's at stake here, again, members, is the possibility of our state losing $7 million unless we act in an expedited manner in order to align with federal new federal rights.
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mariani, well, my understanding was the department already has rulemaking authority. Is there some specific date that they're not able to make through the normal rulemaking process?
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, Pepin, I'll channel former Representative Greiling here, where, you know, as a legislator, I don't want to simply just assume that the executive branch has rulemaking unless we give them the permission to do that. The amendment here sunsets this. I mean, we can certainly keep this open-ended for them, but I think it's appropriate for legislatures to consistently review the, all the executive branch's behavior relative to rulemaking.
Representative Pepin.
Well, thank you. I know you're in a hurry here. I don't know how, you know, the expedited rulemaking process really takes out the public and it takes out the policy part of it, and I'm just uncomfortable with it, and that's why I'll be voting against it today.
Representative Spelsky, quickly, we're going to vote on this in 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it seems, Representative Mariani, that we are expediting our legislative process in order to bring expedited rulemaking for a $7 million payment that has a track record of not being paid. Are we sure that as we change all our rules and shuffle the deck and do all this expeditious work, are we sure that it's going to be worth it?
Representative Mayor Murray, quickly.
Mr. Chair, it's worth it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will make my comments brief. What's broken in Chapter 14 this time, because this is the, what, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th bill that we've seen that has asked for exception to rulemaking, and I'm just going back on the record with my comments from before. If 14's broken, let's fix it. If it's not, then let's not take exceptions to the rulemaking process.
Members, I'll renew my motion that House File 1705 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Rules Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it.
Thank you, Mr.
The bill
Chairman.
Is passed. Members, we meet again tomorrow at 10 and in the basement, and we also have a room reserved for the evening. We have a few other bills we have to hear, and so with that, this meeting is adjourned.